This is the Angry GM, and this is another Angry GM's Proof Read Aloud, hosted by the Angry GM, a read aloud of an article being posted at theangrygm.com. Anyway, today's article, which we will be proofreading aloud, or which I will be proofreading aloud, and you will be proof listening to aloud, is Game Mastering Makes No Sense. And I do have a live studio audience on hand listening as I proofread aloud, who will be providing questions and comments to fill out the supplemental Q&A podcast, which will be posted immediately after this. All right, ground rules out of the way, introduction out of the way. Let's get started with Game Mastering Makes No Sense. You're back, huh? I guess you liked my take on true game mastering. Either that, or you just found my site, and you have no idea what the hell I'm talking about. Well, if you are new here, this is the second part in a year-long 25-ish part journey, The Way of the True Game Master. Go check out that first part I linked to find out more. Still here? Great! That means you want to be a true game master. And now that you're totally sold on owning your game and building investment, let me hack apart that enthusiasm like it's a troll and I've got a flaming Vorpal greatsword. That's right, it's reality check time. Heading: ownership, investment, you learned them, now forget them. And I feel that should be a semicolon in there. Ownership, investment, you learned them, now forget them. I spewed a lot of words about how true game masters earn player investment with great narratives and great gameplay experience, and by taking full ownership of their tabletop role-playing game adventures, campaigns, and sessions last week. And now, I want you to forget I said any of that crap, because I'm sure gonna. I'm probably never again going to mention ownership or investment, except in passing. Instead, I'm going to teach you lots of specific techniques and provide lots of advice, none of which will seem to be remotely related to ownership or investment. Hell, some of my lessons will seem to take you in completely the wrong direction. But I promise you that every word I write, not counting sarcastic remarks, asides, and sidebars, every word I write is written with the express purpose of helping you build player investment or own your game. What gives? Why no more talk of investment or ownership? And why am I going to instruct you to do things that you're absolutely, totally, completely, categorically sure will make for worse gameplay and narrative experiences? Partly, it's because I'm the expert and you're not, and if you knew good advice from bad, you wouldn't need me. That's me taking ownership of my work, by the way. But mostly, it's just the nature of the beast. It's just how game mastering is. Heading: the art of mastering the game. Game mastering isn't a skill. Game mastering is an art. And that isn't pedantical semantical bullshit, because I don't do pedantical semantical bullshit. There's a huge difference between art and skill. Really huge. If the difference were a figure on a grid, it'd be at least 5 squares across. And you have to understand the difference if you want to master game mastering. Arts are complex. Game mastering is complex. No duh, Angry, right? Everyone knows that. But hold on there, smartass. I didn't say complicated. I said complex. The art of game mastering is a complex synthesis of many, many different skills. Way too many for me to list on this site because I have to pay for my storage by the byte. But I can rattle off a few. There's game design and storytelling, obviously, which are themselves complex arts. There's communication and logistics and creative writing and conflict resolution and leadership and social interaction and information management and information presentation and puzzle design and logistics and organization and on and on and on and on and on. And the art of game mastering isn't just the sum of all those skills. It's a synthesis. The skills come together to something greater than the sum of the individual skills. It's like painting. Painting involves brush technique, color theory, composition, perspective, working with specific materials, tool maintenance, and a thousand other things I can't list because I'm not a painter. And you could master every one of those individual skills and still not paint anything people actually want to pay for or look at. Because putting together texture and composition and, whoop, hold on, I made a word error there. Okay. Painting involves brush technique, color theory, composition, perspective, working with specific materials, tool maintenance, and a thousand other things I can't list because I'm not a painter. And you could master every one of those individual skills and still not paint anything people actually want to pay for or look at. Because putting together texture and composition and color choice and brush technique and using the right media, that synthesis is an art in itself. That's game mastering. You can master every single individual skill involved and still run sucky games. And like some talented painters, you can run amazing games without having any idea how any of the individual skills work in a vacuum. Arts are subjective. Game masters produce experiences that are part game and part narrative. In other words, they produce entertainment experiences. Entertainment is entirely subjective. It's about evoking emotional responses in your audience. Emotions aren't rational or reasonable. They can't be understood in logical terms. They've got to be felt. Does this mean there's no way to be a true game master? After all, subjective experiences vary, by definition, from person to person. How can someone produce a satisfying subjective experience for anyone else, or for anyone outside of a very small number of very similar people? Well, who cares how it's possible? It is, and you know it is. If it weren't possible for artists to create broadly appealing emotional experiences, there'd be no popular culture. Part of being an artist is having a knack for creating subjective experiences that satisfy lots of other people. There are actually many ways to evoke emotional experiences across broad groups of people, even across sociocultural lines. People's brains are more similar than different, and when it comes to game design and storytelling, there's a giant pile of great games and stories that show you just what kind of experiences touch lots of people in lots of similar ways. And now a sidebar. Feedback is sus AF, and I have to change so many, like, views of myself as a person. Because I just realized that I use the phrase sus AF in a piece of work. But anyway, nonetheless, feedback is sus AF. Game masters hear a lot of feedback, whether they want it or not. As a game master, you're probably inclined to go digging for feedback. You probably think it's a good thing. But you have to treat all feedback with extreme levels of skepticism. And that's down to how brains work. Enjoyment, engagement, and investment, those are emotions. And they come from very old, very fast, very snap judgment parts of your brain. And you don't know them, you feel them. In general, humans are pretty good at knowing how they're feeling. At least, they know if they're feeling good or bad. The problem is reason and understanding and analysis come from totally different brain parts. Newer and slower parts that don't know anything about feelings. And I missed a word there. Newer and slower parts that don't know anything about feelings. When you try to figure out why you feel the way you do, a part of your brain that doesn't speak emotion is trying to understand the emotions in a totally disconnected, different part of your brain. And it rarely gets it right. In general, people know whether they like what they've got, but they're bad at explaining why, and they are absolutely awful at guessing what they'll like before they've got it. Keep that in mind when you seek feedback and never ever ask the players to assess anything they haven't experienced. And now back to the main article. Getting good at arting. If game mastering is a complex synthesis of an unfathomably large number of skills and can't be understood logically or rationally, how the hell can you, or anyone, possibly learn how to do it? First, let me reassure you that you can learn it. I'm betting my livelihood on that because teaching you how to do it is, God help me, my career now. And I really don't want to dust off my accounting degree and go back to the debit mines. Fortunately, your brain is hardwired to learn complex subjective arts, provided you get the hell out of its way. Let me tell you about experiential learning. Subheading: the best teacher is experience. You've learned many, many very complex skills just by actually doing things. Playing video games, driving a car, navigating the complex social drama that is a holiday home with your family. Those are very complex skills, and you didn't learn them from one weekend with a driving instructor or from a politically charged website telling you to disown any member of your family whose opinion differs from yours. You learn them through experience. When you do something, or try to, all the parts of your brain involved in that task light up like overloaded Christmas bulbs. That is not how a neuroscientist would explain it, but I'm not a neuroscientist, so I don't have to be accurate. When you were learning to drive and pulled out of your driveway, a bunch of different brain bits all fired at once. The bits that control your hand on the gear shift lit up. The bits that process your tactile senses as the gear shift clunked into place sparked an arc. So did the bits that control your eye and neck muscles to shift your field of vision, and so did the bits that control your foot muscles and the bits that process auditory input and heard the angry honk from the approaching car. Your brain was like Times Square on New Year's Eve. When brain bits fire off at once, your brain assumes you need those parts to work together. So it quickly wires some extra connections between those parts. And every time those parts fire off in sync, your brain wires more connections between them. This is down to a thing called neuroplasticity, which is a neuroscience term. But that ain't all. The quick, emotional, hyper-aware, snap judgment part of your brain is also constantly evaluating what's going on. And it's drinking in a vast array of sensory information to do so. Far more information than you're consciously aware of taking in. And it's monitoring things like stress hormones triggered by an approaching moving thing in your peripheral vision and the fear that you're about to die. And it decides whether things are going well or going poorly. When things are going well, every new connection your brain builds, it builds tough. When things are going badly, your brain builds weak, iffy, tentative connections. Kind of. Again, I'm not a neuroscientist, and I'm generalizing a lot. That's experiential learning, and triggering it deliberately is called practicing. And it's the only way to master a complex skill. Once you know the basics of how to turn a car on and obey the rules of the road, the only way to learn to drive is to practice. Same with game mastering. Once you can get a bunch of friends together and muddle through a game, all you can do to master the art is to keep running games. Mostly. But before I continue with that, a sidebar. Citation not needed. I've been running games for several decades and writing about games for over a decade. In that time, I've consumed a hell of a lot of information on a crap ton of topics. See, I realized early that if I wanted to really understand this whole GMing thing, insofar as it's possible to understand it, I need to understand lots of other things, too. Things like story structure and game design and human psychology. I've devoured countless credible books on many topics, and I've used what I learned to adjust my GMing style accordingly. That combination of lay research and practical experience, that's what I'm sharing with you, out of the goodness of my heart. I am not writing an academic paper. this site isn't going to earn me a PhD in role-playing games administration or anything. And I frankly don't care if you agree with me or use my advice. I'm not out to prove anything. I'm just offering you a shortcut, and you can take it if you want it. You can do what I did. You can read The Paradox of Choice and Thinking Fast and Slow and Screenplay and Sway and Behavioral Economics, The Basics and 12 Rules for Life and The Hero's Journey and You Are Not So Smart and The First 20 Hours and The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People and Designing for How People Learn or any of the other dozens of books occupying my shelf right now, all of whose lessons I'm absolutely not qualified to teach, but will nevertheless summarize so you can pretend to be an elf better. Or you can take the shortcut I'm offering because it's just pretend elf games. Just don't ask me to prove what I know because there's no margin in that and I don't care if you believe me. Now back to the article. Subheading: Exploiting Your Game for Maximum Game Mastery. Let's see if I can squeeze something more concrete out of this than, all you can do is mostly just run games until they're good. There are actually four things you can do to supercharge your brain's experiential learning potential, and I'm going to help you with three of them. One, above all, run games. I can't overstate the importance of practice. If you want to master game mastering, you have to run games. Lots of games. As many as you can. This is the single most important path to mastery. So if you've only got 4 hours a week to devote to this entire hobby, spend every last minute of them running games. Quit watching videos, reading my website, or doing anything that isn't running games. That'll earn you master status the fastest with the time you've got. Two, feed your brain the good stuff. If you're running all the games you can conceivably run, the next best thing you can do is show your brain what good subjective experiences look like. Consume media you enjoy. Read books, watch movies, good movies, nothing released after 2010, and play games, board games and video games. Fill your brain with examples of good narratives and good gameplay experiences. That'll help your intuitive snap judgment brain tell good tabletop role-playing game experiences from bad. It's also worth immersing yourself in some tabletop role-playing game-specific media. Read about the hobby or watch videos about it. But that's less valuable than training your brain separately to recognize both good narrative experiences and good gameplay experiences. This is one of two reasons why I suggest not going overboard consuming streamed tabletop role-playing games or actual play podcasts. Three, work on your form. I need a sip. Three, work on your form. If you're running games and you're consuming non-tabletop role-playing gaming media, and you've still got some free time, use that time to work on specific skills and techniques. Game mastery is a complex synthesis of many skills. You can practice some of those skills directly, especially if there's a specific skill that's giving you trouble. It's kind of like having a trainer help you correct your form. But, and I cannot stress this enough, too much of this crap isn't learning. It actually detracts from learning if you overdo it. So try to work on one skill at a time. May I humbly suggest a good source for tabletop role-playing game immersion and help with form? Well, if you're looking to immerse yourself in tabletop role-playing gaming specific advice to supplement your enjoyment of related games and stories and get help with specific game mastering techniques, I know the perfect place. And it needs your support to stay online. But I digress. Four, relax your brain. Do you want to make this experiential learning crap as difficult as possible? Do you want to turn game mastering into a protracted, insufferable ordeal? One that's likely doomed to fail? Just get your conscious brain involved. Your conscious, rational, logical brain isn't useful with the subjective. Mostly it's just there to guess what the subjective parts of your brain are doing so it can go looking for stuff to make your subjective brain happy. And it sucks at that because it doesn't speak the language. While the very old, capable parts of your brain are mastering very complex skills, your conscious brain is endlessly asking, what are you doing? Why? What's that for? How does that work? Does it work? How do you know? Are you even doing this right? I don't think you're doing it right. Want to see what I mean? Find a recipe for a complex dish you've never prepared before. Something really challenging, like beef Wellington or consommé or that blowfish that kills you if you make a single tiny mistake. Now, borrow a 2-year-old child, or make your own, and ask the 2-year-old child to help you prepare the dish. Gamers like logic and reason. That's why they obsess over which dice rolling techniques are best and least swingy, and how to achieve perfect game balance, even though that crap doesn't matter or doesn't exist. As a game master, you're tempted to analyze everything, or as a gamer, you're tempted to analyze everything. So you might think recording your game sessions and analyzing them is a good idea. Or you might spend more time watching videos analyzing games and stories than you spend playing games and watching movies. Or you might try to implement every piece of advice I give you into every game perfectly. Game design analysis is interesting. It's worth consuming once in a while, but it won't help you as much as consuming good games will. My advice can help you overcome a sticky problem at the table, but if you try to memorize and implement every word I write, instead of just letting it mostly slosh around in your unconscious, it'll screw up your practice. And if you record every session and listen for all the mistakes, you'll convince yourself you're a sucky game master, and your brain will be a stew of stress hormones more toxic than a blowfish souffle prepared with the help of a toddler. Stress is also why it's a bad idea to absorb too many actual play role-playing game podcasts and streams until you're very confident in your own abilities. If you're like most people, you'll endlessly compare yourself to those other better GMs. Comparisons like that lead to stress, and stress leads to continued game mastering suckage. In short, trust your brain to do its thing without your attention. Don't analyze or overthink, and don't try to work on more than one aspect of your form at a time. Mostly, just relax and run games. Heading: Why My Lessons Won't Make Sense. Now that I'm done explaining a very complex aspect of neurophysiology I'm wholly unqualified to talk about, let me get back to the point. Because, yes, I had a point when I started, and I'd kind of like to make it. First, throughout the rest of what I'm laughably calling a course in game mastery, I'm not going to talk much about investment or ownership, even though I claim those ideas were central to true game mastery. Second, a lot of my future lessons will leave you saying, how the hell can this possibly lead to increased ownership or investment? Or worse, leave you saying, oh hell no, this is just going to lead to crap games my players will hate. Why? Well, there's a bunch of reasons. First, game mastering isn't just about subjective experience. It's about long-term subjective experiences. It's about creating experiences that feel good for weeks, months, or years. True game masters worry more about how the game will feel tomorrow or next month than how it feels right now. After all, there's only ever one present moment, but there's an infinity of future moments. At least there would be if game masters weren't mortal humans and role-playing game campaigns didn't tend to peter out after 6 months. Human brains are really weird, especially when it comes to the interplay between present moment pleasure and long-term engagement. For instance, in the long run, humans are happier with decisions they can't undo. I know that's counterintuitive, but it's true. And it happens because your brain actually does a bunch of secret behind-the-scenes work to gradually make you accept things you can't control. If you know you can undo a decision at any time, your brain is constantly reevaluating the decision. And no decision stands up to that kind of long-term scrutiny. That's called the law of diminishing returns. The point is, if you want to drastically increase the odds your players will be happy with their characters in the long term, don't allow any kind of retraining or take-backsies and make it really hard to retire characters. See what I mean? This crap is bonkers sometimes. Second, game mastering is a complex art, right? So there were a lot of moving parts. Every change changes something else. And those changes don't just propagate through the whole system, they compound on themselves. A lot of times I'll tell you to make small changes that do a lot of different things at once. For example, when I tell you to limit the number of available races in your TTRPG campaign, it's not just because people tend to be more creative under constraints, though that's true, and it's not just because people tend to be more satisfied with long-term choices when forced to select from smaller numbers of options, though that's true too, and it's not just because it trains you to take ownership of your campaign, though it does, and it's not just because it's easier for you to build strong identities for a small number of races than a large number of races, and thereby makes it feel like your world's inhabited by several distinct fantasy races instead of a hodgepodge of funny-looking humanish things, though it does that too. Limiting the number of races does all of that crap, and it does more stuff besides. That's why it's bonkers when people try to figure out the one specific reason for anything I do. I never do things for just one reason. Relatedly, and third, that same complexity means game mastering choices are rife with unintended consequences. That's when a choice you make has an undesirable side effect, when fixing something breaks something else. Suppose, for instance, you impose strict ammo and ration tracking in your role-playing game campaign. Good on you. That's a great way to build investment. But suppose you also think long and hard about encumbrance tracking and decide it's a bunch of fiddly complexity that doesn't add much depth to the game. It's a pain in the ass and does the game no good. That's also a totally reasonable game decision. But when your players realize that without weight limits, they can carry as much ammo and food as they can afford, tracking that stuff doesn't matter at all anymore. No one's ever going to run out. Bingo bango, unintended consequence. And now a sidebar. Ass pains are immersive. Maybe you've noticed that I keep mentioning fiddly little pain-in-the-ass mechanics like supply and ammo tracking. Mechanics that players like to piss and moan about and that GMs like to throw away. Guess what? They're actually really valuable. And they're valuable because they're a pain in the ass. It's all about immersion. Immersion is a player's ability to pretend they're not playing a game despite all the evidence they are. Or, less sarcastically, immersion is a player's ability to lose themselves in the fantasy of the game. The thing is, immersion isn't hard to achieve. Human brains love immersion, and they're willing to ignore all sorts of sensory evidence to maintain it. You know this is true. You've lost yourself in movies and video games, even though sitting for so long made your ass hurt and the controller was giving you thumb cramps. One thing that helps maintain immersion is constant reminders that things work how they should. If you have to tick off an arrow every time you shoot a foe, you have to think of the arrow as a real physical thing and you have to stress over how many arrows you have left. Instead of the act of making a mark on a paper reminding you that you're playing a game, your dumb brain clings to the fact that it feels like the sort of thing an archer would stress over, and therefore you feel like an archer. The more little reminders that you're simulating a world and not just playing an abstract game, the stronger the immersion. And the more pain-in-the-ass bookkeeping you drop for the sake of convenience, the shakier the illusion that you're doing anything but pushing dice around. Heading: Making Progress. Sip. Game mastering is the complex art of creating subjective entertainment experiences that marry the best aspects of games and stories. You can only master it experientially, it can't be understood rationally, and all the best advice is weird and counterintuitive. As such, while I'll do my best to explain as much as I can, you're going to have to trust me sometimes and just keep chugging along. The problem is, chugging along takes a long time and it won't feel good. Practice is hard and painful and slow. It hurts to do things you're not good at, and you can only make incrementally tiny improvements, so you won't ever notice your making progress. And you can't trust the feedback you get from your audience half the time. How the hell are you supposed to keep your spirits up? Because you've got to keep your spirits up. If you get stressed, you stop learning. In short, how can you reassure yourself you're making progress? I'll tell you what a local golf pro told me as he struggled to help me suck a little less at golf. It's the only thing I actually learned from him, but that's my fault, not his, because I didn't commit to practice. Do as I say, not as I do. Anyway, the golf pro told me to judge my progress by the worst swings, not the best. Great golf shots are really rare, especially for amateurs, and great shots don't improve much over time. But if I kept practicing, I'd notice my worst swings would get less and less bad. If I kept practicing, I'd stop merely scaring the ball by swinging my club past it. I'd connect more. Sure, I'd send the ball caroming off at impossible angles or into the parking lot, but I'd do that less and less too. Soon, although the ball wasn't going anywhere near where I was aiming, it was posing a lot less danger to other golfers and passers-by with every swing. I was moving the ball forward. This ain't a glamorous way to judge success. My crappy games get slightly less crappy with every session is about as humble a brag as you can tweet. But it is progress. And when you're struggling to stick with something hard, you have to cling to anything that looks like progress just to keep from feeling like a failure. But that's enough of a pep talk from me. Next time, I'll help you improve an actual game mastering skill. I'll help you narrate better, or at least less crappily. And we will end with a sidebar: trust and patience. I've asked you a few times now to trust me enough to test my advice at the table instead of judging it by reading it, because that's the only way to judge anything as complex as game mastering. This is why I don't judge a role-playing game system or mechanic until I've used it at my own table, and why I ignore any opinion of my work that doesn't start, "Well, I followed your advice for 3 months." Keep in mind that when I'm asking for your trust, I'm asking for long-term trust. First, remember, it takes 2 or 3 sessions before any change feels remotely comfortable. When you change your game's rules or your technique, you spend the first 3 sessions just remembering what you changed and how. It takes you 3 sessions just to internalize the change. Second, all my advice is about long-term, incremental improvements. It takes some time for any change to really affect the entire complex system that is a tabletop role-playing game campaign. And the direct, observable results might be pretty small. This means you need another 2 or 3 weeks after you're used to the change before you'll see any impact at all. The point is, you've got to be in this for the long haul. Once you adopt a change, you need to stick with it for 6 to 12 sessions. Only then can you ask yourself if your game is going well. If you're happy with your game 12 sessions after you made a change, the change was probably a good one, even if you can't see what exactly it's doing. If you're not happy with your game 12 sessions after a change, the change is either not helping or it's making things worse, so dump it. The same is true on the other side of the screen, by the way. Players resist change. It takes 2 or 3 sessions before players stop resisting or resenting any change. Then it takes 2 or 3 more sessions before they're used to it, and 2 or 3 more sessions before they can decide if they're happy. And for the sake of all that is good and holy, do not ask your players if they'll accept a change. Just tell them you're changing things, and you'll let them know when you want their feedback. In 12 weeks. And that is the end of the Proofread Aloud, and next time, we will talk about narration.